I know this one isn't available at the PI library. Some of the others Philip and I have checked out, so it might be hard to get them. This is online, so Callum, if you could post a link to it. At least it's accessible, more so than the textbooks. So we left off yesterday with deep inelastic scattering and the parton model in that context. One can also apply it to the thing we're really interested in, which is proton-proton collisions. And the basic picture there, you've got one proton barreling in, and now instead of an electron, another proton. But the picture is that each little subsystem really looks the same as in the inelastic scattering case we just discussed. So the proton will do its thing, but we're going to focus on one hard parton with some momentum x1, some energy fraction x1, and of type I. So this could be I equals some type of quark, anti-quark, or gluon. The other proton does the same thing, some x2 and particle type J. And then we want to focus on events where there are two hard pieces. They scatter, basically, free particle free 2 to 2 scattering, just like we're used to for electrons, except with additional possible pieces. And this little process, this hard process, is always, all of its variables are always denoted by hats. So the cross section for this little piece is a sigma hat, the center of mass energy of that piece. Center mass energy squared is denoted by S hat. S hat is just equal to x1 times the product of their energies, right? It's x1 e. X1, x2 times the center mass energy of the total of the full collider, right? Just because each one gets penalized by an x. And then the outcome particles A and B. Now, if these A and B are strongly interacting, then, as I know you talked about in the standard model class, and we'll probably talk about some features of it again later, they can have additional radiation, and you have to, this process you can think of as all taking place on very short length scales. As you look at it on larger and larger length scales, QCD becomes very strong, and you're guaranteed to have this radiation. And then eventually, hadronization and these turn into, say, pions, et cetera, form what's called a jet. And then, that's the picture of the whole event, from initial protons to final jets or electrons or what have you. And the part that we really want to study to explore new physics is this sigma hat, this hard process. But we live in a world where we have to view things on length scales much larger than the QCD scale. And also, I should say, this parton shower, I just described it as having to do with evolving to higher scales. But one can also think of the showering part of it as just classical radiation. We'll come back to that later. I'm not going to elaborate now. But this is the picture. And the formula that goes with the picture is that d sigma dx, where x, there's some specifics about what x is. X is meant to describe sort of inclusive kinematic variables. For the final state, so for example, things involving the jets, it's equal to the sum over the different types, I and j, of partons that can participate, times the integral dx1, f of x1 times some q associated with the initial state. Integral dx2, f of x2 times q times a d sigma hat dx hat times what's called a fragmentation function for x hat going to x. Now, there's a lot of subtlety involved. So these terms should look very familiar. These are just like inelastic scattering. Exactly the same thing, just probing the distribution of partons in the proton. Now, there's some subtlety in the fact that you can write it this way. Unlike the electron-proton case, we had a very clear separation of scales, right? Very hard interaction, high energy transfer between the electron and the parton. And then the only thing that knew about the QCD scale was that single proton itself. Here, in principle, you can have gluons of very low energy scattering between these guys, those can actually lead to effects that violate this kind of formula. But one can ignore them if you define clear enough, inclusive enough observables, then they're a higher order correction. And some of them are also included in the Monte Carlos. So I just want to alert you to the fact that this kind of formula can lead to false conclusions, but if you use it within its domain of applicability, it also has worked very well in describing data. Non-factorization effects. So this formula here is called the factorization theorem. And I mean, it is basically a theorem of QCD. When the proofs of it go through carefully accounting for all these different kinds of soft gluon that you might worry about, how they affect the cross-section, and what kinds of quantities they don't affect. Some of these problematic ones are called Glauber gluons, and so on. It's kind of fascinating, but also not directly relevant to what we're doing. And so now, as I've drawn it, where does perturbation theory take, where do higher order corrections appear in this formula? Well, you've got two different kinds of treatments. This hard process, you typically just think of it in perturbation theory, right? You would have a sigma hat 0 plus sigma hat 1, which is higher order in alpha, and so forth. There's just perturbation theory calculations going on in here. These, the parton distributions, also have a scale, and they also include higher order corrections, but they do it differently through this Altarelli-Parisi evolution. Right, so you're really talking about QCD effects. When you write this formula, QCD effects at all scales are present, but there's basically the lowest scale you ever need to think about is lambda QCD. Highest scale is roughly of order the center mass collision. And there's some factorization scale QF that's the dividing line between the things you think about in terms of perturbation theory of the hard process and down here the effects you think about as evolution of PDFs. And likewise, when you talk about this perturbation theory, there's also, people usually use renormalized perturbation theory, so it's renormalized at a scale. This isn't a final, this is just factorization. One can have different initial and final state factorizations, but it's renormalized at some scale, Q,
QR,
normalization scale. People often talk about getting uncertainties on a cross-section by varying these two scales, because when you vary those two scales, you're just changing how you parametrize. You know, if you have different approximations of QCD on each side of this line, by varying it, you see how sensitive the result is to your approximations. Now, again, a lot of this, I just want to emphasize, it's not something that we need to use on a daily basis to understand most of the salient features of collider production, but it's something you should be aware of and understanding. Certainly comes up in the literature in trying to understand things carefully. So are there questions about this picture? Yes, I started drawing my PDFs, but I didn't finish yesterday. So I will just sketch out. Again, there's this notion of a valence and a C parton distribution function, where the valence comes from the sort of constituent up and down quarks of the proton, and the C comes from all the pairs and gluons that are produced quantum mechanically. They have very different distributions. So in a PP collider, the only valence quarks, the valence quarks are important at higher x. Now I'm going to plot f of x times x. This is appropriate for q of a TeV, although I promise I won't draw it well enough to matter. From roughly 10 to the minus 4 to 1 in x. So the valence quarks have a sort of distribution like that. The running from their peak value is somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 or a little below it, down to like 10 to the minus 2. And then the C's have much more, for both gluons and quarks, look more like this. For the gluons, they actually go above 1. Down here, again, it's f of x times x. This is glue, valence. And the other C quarks are down here, roughly an order of magnitude below the glue. So let's say that you're talking about a 7 TeV machine, center of mass energy, and you want to produce a Z. Then you're talking about having x1 times x2 times 7 TeV squared equals mz squared. So that means the typical x1 is of order mz over 7 TeV, which is about 1%. It's order of 1%. And likewise, if you want to produce two top quarks, it's about 1/20. Top mass is 175 JeV. So in all cases, we're talking about, for those processes, living sort of in the middle in this crossover region of the PDFs, where if accessible, the valence quarks can give certain processes a boost, but gluons also play a really important role. In fact, top production at the LHC, unlike the Tevatron, Tevatron is running at 2 TeV, and x is about 1/10. And they also have both protons and antiprotons. So at that kind of x, the valence quarks are very important. They can have a valence quark, valence antiquark annihilation into a top quark. At the LHC, top is actually dominated by the gluons. Now, let's go ahead and look at and play massage this formula a little bit. I'm going to erase the picture. And because I'm going to care about sort of order of magnitude estimates, I'm going to erase the fragmentation function too. Because not going to matter for what I tell you about. The fragmentation functions are also relevant for asking somewhat more detailed questions. Like if you want to ask about the probability of getting a B meson as opposed to some baryon out of a process, the fragmentation functions are crucial there. When you ask very inclusive questions about jets, that's not so important. But now, the reason I want to massage this formula is that it's all somehow very much written in terms of the properties of the two partons. We really care about the center of mass. I mean, because x1 and x2 can be different, let's say you're producing a z, that z can be boosted. But we really care more about that center of mass frame, its properties, and then what's going on inside the center of mass frame. So a convenient way of writing this is to define a parameter tau, which is equal to, is this blocked behind the board? Okay. Tau is just S hat over S of the collider. So it's equal to x1 times x2. And right, x1 is root tau times e to the y. x2 is root tau e to the minus y. And now this y is equal to really the boost of the CM frame. So, I mean, in terms of more familiar things, cosh y is equal to gamma, the gamma factor. So y is the rapidity. All right, when you do this, now one can work out the Jacobian. dx1, dx2 is just equal to d tau dy. So one can write this as d sigma dx. Now I'll forget about all these, the difference between the two x's. Just write d sigma is equal to the sum over I and j integral d tau dy f of root tau e to the y I fj of root tau e to the minus y. And this now, these, let's talk a little bit about the limits of these integrals. So in this case, clearly the highest each x can be is 1. If you care about a process that has momentum where you're producing a total center. Yeah.
Question about the x's there. Yeah. In the picture before, you had them labeled x1i and x2j, and we're summing over I and j now, we're not.
Ah, sorry. So here I'm so sorry. Yeah, in the picture I was labeling, really think of x1. X1 is the energy density, I is the energy fraction, I is just a label for what kind of particle it is. So in all cases, we're summing over I and J. I'm just being inconsistent about labeling the X by also, right? You don't need to label the X by that, but you do need to sum over it.
It is the same X, though.
It's the same X, yeah. So, the X1, I was really in the picture. I was labeling each line by an x1 and an I that are separate, right? So it's like a quark or an anti-quark with energy fraction x. Yeah, sorry, that wasn't clear. And so now, I mean, there's a lower bound on each of these integrals just because you want x1 times x2 to be big enough to produce the center mass energy, to produce a given center mass energy. In this language, and it's just S hat over S. So this guy can be very slow moving if this one's very fast moving, and vice versa. When you map that range into tau and y, what you find is that tau can run also from 1 to s hat over s. And the to s hat min over s for the process. Tau is running over s hat, is s hat over s, so that's kind of a trivial statement. And the y integral goes from some minus y max to y max, where this y max is equal to it's just requiring that the bigger of these, root tau e to the y max, is an x, so it had better be less than 1. You can't have a parton carrying more than the conduction energy, but the total proton energy. So that means that y max is just equal to log 1 over a half log 1 over tau. And so, this varies, for example, for z at the LHC. It's about 4.3. There's also an absolute range of y's that's relevant for any collider. Just the mass of the lowest the x can be is the mass of the proton, right? And the highest it can be is the center of mass energy. And that sort of y max absolute is about 8.9 for the LHC. I'm only mentioning these numbers to give you the idea that this y has a pretty compact range because it's sort of a logarithmic quantity. Now, something you'll note about this: these f's can locally, even this one that looks like it's rising. If you plot it as f of x instead of f x times x, all of these are falling distributions. Locally in any region, they sort of look, you can use Taylor's theorem, they roughly look like falling power laws. And the F for producing, getting to the Z mass from two equally energetic partons, or from one fast parton and one slow parton, is sort of comparable. So actually, when you do this Y integral, it's getting sort of comparable contributions from this plateau, not equal contributions, but roughly comparable contributions from this whole y range. But actually, when you integrate it, it's convenient, since all we really care about is what we're producing in the center of mass frame. It's convenient to just give this integral a name. So this integral is conventionally, it's also nice to make just cosmetic, multiplying and dividing by tau. So this is now sort of a logarithmic integral. This quantity is often called the parton luminosity, which is just a function of tau. It's really a function of tau and the center of mass energy of the collider because of these y maxes. Because these y maxes depend on both. This is a y max of tau, depend also on s. But that's a sort of weaker dependence. It only goes logarithmically. And this is actually conventionally, stick to this convention. Sometimes people write a 1 over s here, sometimes they don't. In any case, this is called the parton luminosity. There's just a fair number of definitions that I have to get through. But we're almost done with that. So we can apply this formula to, say, Z production or W production. In the case of a W, if we ignore the W width, sorry, I dropped the all-important d sigma hat over here. So notice that here the, I'm going to drop the one on the rest too. This is dimensionless as written. This is dimensionless. This carries the dimensions of the cross-section back into here. So that's a nice way of writing it. For the W, the cross-section for QQ bar goes to W, can just be written ignoring the W width. It's pi root 2 over 3 G Fermi times FW squared times delta of S hat minus MW squared. Right? You only produce it at the mass of the W if you're just talking about single production. And so that lets us plug in to solve for tau. I can write this then d sigma, just sigma for producing pp to w is just the sum over the different kinds of quarks and antiquarks, same flavor if I ignore CKM mixing. I'll be clearer in the body of the integral. D tau, this F of course has an I and a J index as well. Sorry, I'm not keeping track of those from the beginning. D tau over tau, which I can also just write as DS hat over S hat, times this parton luminosity for a QI, Q bar I, being the I and the J, at tau and S, times sigma hat for QQ bar I goes to W. And this is exactly the same kind of production formula that you'd have for any other process. In this case, the sigma hat is very simple. It's just a delta function in S hat. And so you get sum over QI times 1 over MW squared FQI QI bar of MW squared over S and S times all this, pi root 2 over 3. Let me write G Fermi with the wrong, forget the order 1 numbers. This is basically parametrically an alpha 2 over MW to the fourth is G Fermi. This should be, no, that's right. It's just an alpha 2 over MW squared times MW squared. Good. So now these cancel. It's just an alpha 2 times some order 1 numbers that I haven't kept track of. And so the sigma is just 1 over MW squared times some alphas times the parton luminosity at the W mass. Now, the important thing to note is that this parton luminosity is typically, roughly, very roughly, you can think of it as scaling as just MW over S to some negative power. Right? So now, in other words, the higher this x, the tau is, the lower the rate of producing it. Right? All of these are steeply falling functions of tau. of x's. So the integral is the steeply falling function of tau. What this means is that the cross section actually goes like 1 over mw to the 2 plus q s to the q. Now, this is a behavior that you haven't seen in the scattering of point-like particles. This actually grows, this differential cross-section grows with s. So the higher you're in an E plus E minus collider, you always see cross-sections that go like 1 over s. Right? And our parton cross-section, in general, would go like 1 over s. Here, this cross-section actually grows. The higher energy your collider, the more z's you produce. All right, so the next important case to look at is two-particle production. But before I do that, I think I'll get to that tomorrow. We can do a little bit of kinematic variables. And, you know, this is all sort of the learning the ropes of what things look like at colliders. There's a lot of definitions. There's a lot of this variable and that variable and, you know, this set of coordinates and another that can be a little dry. But it's how we figure out the answers using data to all of the important questions that I was listing on the board yesterday. That was sort of the pick-me-up before learning about what I just discussed and what I'm about to discuss, which is, so you're talking about some Z production, and it decays to E plus E minus, and we have a detector. We need to describe the coordinates in some way. What is the useful way of describing, of parametrizing the momenta in these processes? So as I said several times now, this Z can be produced boosted, can be produced at rest. What we really care about is measuring the decay products of the Z, so as much as possible you want to use boost invariant variables. I'll start over here. Not generally boost invariant, obviously, for a single particle. The only Lorentz invariant you can write isn't very interesting. It's just the mass. But the Z boost, which is ubiquitous in collider processes, you want to use variables that behave very nicely under it. So if you have some momentum, E, Px, Py, Pz, under a Z boost, obviously E gets changes, Px and Py stay the same. So the first natural boost invariant variables to use, the only ones for single, so for a single particle, the only boost invariant, M is an absolute boost invariant quantity. Px and Py are Z boost invariant. So these are good variables to use. In cylindrical coordinates, one can talk about PT, the transverse momentum, transverse to the beam direction, and phi. So this is now, if we imagine a particle detector, this is just cylindrical. These are two of the cylindrical coordinates on the detector. Right, so our momentum has a magnitude pt and relative to some axis, an angle phi. One can also define, so pt is just the square root of px squared plus py squared, and phi is the arctan, y over x. Can also define mt which is the square root m squared plus pt squared. Actually, you should think about this as an et. It's always less than or equal to the total energy because it doesn't have the z component, right? But it's the lowest possible energy that, if you think in the CM frame of some two-particle collision, you don't know what the z-boost of that frame is. This is the lowest energy of the particle in any such frame. This will play a really key role. This ET and PT is really important when you're talking about invisible particles, because you can actually reconstruct the PT of an invisible particle, say a neutrino in W decay. You can reconstruct the PT by momentum conservation. You know that your initial state has zero PT. You sum up the PTs of all the particles you see, and you're left with the sum of the PTs of the particles you don't see. But since you don't know the initial state's boost along the z direction, you can never reconstruct the full momentum of that particle, just the transverse part. That's another reason to use these variables. But the main one is really the z-boost invariance. Now, we still have one more free parameter in this four momentum. E and pz certainly aren't boost invariant. In fact, if you think about what a boost does, you can write it as some sort of hyperbolic matrix parametrized by some zeta multiplying EPZ. The way we're most used to thinking about this, most of us, is writing this matrix instead as a gamma, gamma, beta, gamma, beta, gamma, right? But here, if you say that cosh zeta is gamma, then sinh squared zeta is just cosh squared zeta minus 1. And that's just gamma beta. So these two are equivalent. The reason I've written it this way is that it motivates a variable that isn't boost invariant, but at least it just translates under boosts. That's useful because it means that if you're taking the difference between two particles, that difference will be invariant. So what you want to do is write E as being proportional to the cosh of something, some y, and PZ, so some A times cosh, PZ is equal to A times the sinh of some y. If you write it this way, then that means that this will simply take cosh y, when you multiply the matrix, to cosh of y plus zeta. So that's the additive property we want, right? It'll just take y to y plus zeta. So what is this y? Well, you can just solve these equations, right? Require that e squared minus pz squared should be equal to a squared times cosh squared y minus sinh squared y, so that's just a squared. Well, if you look back here, that's just this et, right? So et squared is equal to a squared, and then what we want, then we have just e over et is equal to cosh y pz over et is equal to sinh y, and this y, if you look at mass, if you consider the massless limit for a second, so this y is a nice variable. It's boost invariant. It simplifies even further in the case of a massless particle. You can just translate it to something purely geometric, because in that case, e and et are just p and pt. So this is p over pt is cosh y. This is for the massless limit only. P over PT is the cosh. But that's also, if you think now in this picture, it's also 1 over the cosine of theta. And likewise, Pz over Pt is the sinh of y. It's also equal, here's Pz is this edge on the triangle and Pt. So Pz over Pt is just 1 over 10 theta. And this lets, and you can, so you can use these to show that in the massless limit, y is equal to just minus the log of tan theta over 2. And then in general, for massive or massless particles, there's a quantity eta, which is defined to be minus log tan theta over 2. In analogy with this massless behavior, so this is just a purely geometric quantity that behaves nearly like rapidity. So for massless particles, it's boost invariant. And this is something that one can measure in a detector. In fact, if you look at these at an actual detector, it's designed to be segmented so that you get not equal coverage along z, but equal coverage in eta. Because that's the way the particles are actually distributed. And if you just, this is, again, a very nonlinear behavior. So for example, obviously, eta equals 0. Is theta equals 0 up here? But if you look closer and closer to the beam direction, eta equals 1 is about 40 degrees. Sorry, I better draw that somewhere else. Eta equals 1 is about 40 degrees. Eta equals 2 is about 15. Eta equals 3 is about 5.7. And then eta equals 4 is about 2 degrees. And so remember that particles from, that I said the maximum y, which translates to roughly the maximum eta of interesting particles, that are massless particles that are, of massless particles that are produced in the collider, goes all the way up to something like 9. Okay, so that's some tiny angle that it's scattering things at. But for most of the heavy particle production that we're interested in, it's actually focused in this rate range, eta less than about 2. So the bulk of the detector instrumentation is in this region of eta less than about 2. So their main detectors, so the structure of these detectors is always there's a barrel, and then there's some detectors on the end cap. Now, the end cap detectors, I mean, it's really hard to get segmentation down there. These tend to be not as good. The main goal is that this way you can see that something went through, but it's usually not measured very precisely. So this region, I think, is about 2.5. Minus 2.5 to 2.5, the very well-instrumented barrel region. This, I believe, the end cap goes down to about eta of 5. So that's, you know, some degree eta of 5. In addition to do some, there's some kinds of physics for which it's important to, you look for a proton that actually didn't get destroyed by the collision, but just got scattered by a little bit. For that, they want to get out down to having some kind of tagging in this 8 close to 9 region. They actually have sort of have extremely forward detectors that are situated away from the detector, away from the main collision zone, that can get down to some very high eta. I don't know the exact number. Much greater than 5. Something like 9. But the principal detectors measure, see things that are at 8 up to 5, and they measure things really well that are at 8 up to 2.5. It varies with, I mean, for example, Atlas started out only measuring muons out to 1.5, and now they're doing good muon reconstruction out to 3. So part of it is hardware, part of it is just how well they can calibrate the systems in different regions. Yeah, sorry. So eta is pseudo-rapidity. Y is rapidity. And the pseudo-rapidity, so Y is really is a function of momentum and energy. It's really it's kinematic. It depends on the mass. Eta is a purely geometric, eta pseudo-rapidity is a purely geometric quantity. So if you know which cell on your detector some particle hit, well, ignoring the fact that there's a magnetic field that moves things around, if you had no magnetic field, then if you knew which cell on your detector a particle hit, you would know it's eta. But you don't know its rapidity unless you also determine what mass particle it is. Yeah. Oh, sorry. This was all. So Y, the definition of Y is actually this. And then these were all in the massless limit. So this is just in the massless limit, I can make all of these equivalences by taking my E's, replacing all my E's with P's.
So the massless limit rapidity is pseudo.
Right. And in practice, when you're talking about a when you're talking about like a pion that's produced in, you know, from a Z decay is carrying tens of GeV, that's a really good approximation. But when you're talking about the Z itself or a top quark, they're obviously completely different. Most of the particles that one actually that survive that long are light enough that you don't care about the difference. And when we're talking about the kinematics of a massive unstable particle, we typically just use Y for it. But technically, what you measure in the detector is always an eta and not a Y. Just that the measurements usually happen in the regime where it doesn't matter. So I'll do one more thing, which is just talking about. So now we've defined these variables, and it's a simple exercise to just calculate invariant masses in terms of them, just get a feel for how they work. So we can, and that'll let us talk about what Z decays and W decays look like. So. Actually, should I just do this next time? I can just wrap up now. Okay. Yeah. Don't really feel like doing 5 more. Minutes of kinematics will make everybody very happy because we can't get to any fun stuff. But all right, I'll get it over with. So you have a Z that you're producing in your detector, some unknown boost, decays to an electron and a positron. Of course, you'd better have momentum conservation, So mz squared has to be equal to the momentum of the electron plus positron plus the momentum of the electron. Square, and I'm just going to use like P plus and P minus to denote the positron and electron momentum. It's a 4 vector, and of course that's just 2 E plus E minus minus the 3 vector P plus dot P minus. And then I can expand this out into PTs using these formulas. Using the eta formulas, which are just like these, but with PTs rather than ETs. The electron is basically massless, so one can neglect the difference. So this E plus times E minus, well, that's just, again, E is equal to PT times cosh eta. Really, I should say this is the magnitude of the momentum, but in the massless limit. So this is correct for all masses. PZ is equal to PT times sinh eta. Then obviously E is equal to the square root of m squared plus p squared. So I should have written this down earlier, just the mapping from PT and eta to the more familiar kinematic variables. So mz squared in terms of this, I can just pull out the PTs. Everything's going to be proportional to PTs. PT plus PT minus times, for the E terms, I'm going to pick up the, again, it's an electron. Energy is equal to the momentum. I'm just going to pick up these cosh etas. And then for these, there's a PZ. So I can expand this into a PZ squared plus the dot product of the two PT vectors. And here, I mean two vectors. Here, I mean three vectors. That's the one thing that gets very notationally confusing in this business. But anything that you have that has a T, you should just assume is a two vector in the xy plane. So then you subtract off the PZ piece, which is just picking up the sinches. And you subtract off the dot product of the two PTs themselves. But since I already pulled this out, I can just write this as a cos of delta phi times the product of the scalar PTs. Okay. Well, this simplifies. This is just an expression for an expansion of cosh eta plus minus eta minus. So I can write the invariant mass of a two-particle system. This is in general, not specifically for the z, although for the z, it's equal to the mass of the z, as the product of the PTs times the cosh of the delta eta minus minus the cos of the delta phi between the two particles. So this is a general mass formula. It's always obeyed by the decay products of the z. Let's think about a w for a second. Let's say you have a leptonic decay of the w. So you produce a W, it decays to an electron and a neutrino, antineutrino, and this gets lost. It escapes the detector. All you can measure is the electron PT. Well, sorry, you can measure the electron momentum. And if all you produced is the W, then you know that, again, by momentum conservation, the neutrino, the PT of the neutrino has to be equal to minus the PT of the electron. But the eta of the neutrino is unknown. So if you look back at this formula, measuring just the electron and anything else that was produced in the event lets you deduce the PT of the neutrino. So now we have the same formula for a W, but now it's going to be PT of the electron. So this procedure for finding the neutrino momentum, you just define a quantity missing energy, missing transverse energy, which is equal to minus the sum over all the other particles you measure of the PT of the ith particle. And then that has to be the transverse energy of all the invisible things, sum of transverse energies of all the invisible things you produced just by momentum conservation. In this case, we just have one neutrino, so it's the ET of the neutrino. So I can write this, 2pt, cosh delta eta, can't measure the eta of the neutrino, so we can't measure this, minus delta phi, which you can measure. And this, in the simple case of two things decaying back to back, it's always just pi. But if the W had momentum, you could define the delta phi as well. This is strictly greater than or equal to twice PT missing energy times 1 minus cos delta phi, because the minimum of cosh is 1. And this is defined as the transverse mass squared of the W. So one can construct this. If you look at a bunch of W events, what will happen is that the PTs, sometimes you get a W that's very boosted. So the electron and neutrino PT, so that the electron PT and the neutrino PT are relatively small. Sometimes you have a W that declines, in other words, the total momentum is always MW over 2 for each one, if the W is produced along the beam line. But the PT is suppressed. It's MW over 2 cosh eta. So when you're boosted, the PT will be small. When the W is produced at rest, the PT is just MW over 2, so it's maximum. This is actually what's used to reconstruct the mass of the W very precisely, and also its width. Either these PT measurements or the MW both have this characteristic shape that looks, looks something like this. The width, let's say this is MT. The width in MT is actually coming from the physical width of the W, the width of this peak. And then there's the texture effects. And this edge here is at MW. One can also look at the PT of the electron. It has a similar distribution. It's sphered by the width of the W, by the detector, and by a third effect that I think we'll talk about later, which is that the W isn't always produced at rest. In fact, typically, you also have, besides the QQ bar goes to W process, you have processes that look like, QQ bar, get a W that comes out, plus an extra gluon. Or you have a quark and a gluon annihilating to a quark and a W. So in both of these processes, you have some extra thing produced at the same time that carries some of the momentum. And the W actually has some intrinsic PT . That PT of the W doesn't move this this MW edge and MT, but it does smear the PT distribution of the electron. And so all three of these effects are resolvable. And go into the very precise. So like it's incredible. The mass of the W is 80 GeV, right? It's been measured to within 30 MeV. So like we know it to within a third of the muon mass. Yeah. Kind of. I mean, in some cases, yes. But like, if you think about the W, right, the transverse energy of the, so the single particle transverse mass, the thing I call the single particle transverse energy is often called the transverse mass. But then that confuses me, at least, because when you think about the transverse mass of the transverse energy of the W, that's greater than the energy of the W. Sorry, that's greater than the mass of the W, less than the energy of the W. So if you have a boosted W, that's bigger than the mass. Whereas this thing that I'm constructing here is strictly less than the mass of the W. So the transverse energy, if you think about it, for a single particle, I don't have a simple answer. Sometimes people use different notation than me, than what I used here. But I guess all I'm saying is, if you think about, if you imagine parametrizing the kinematics of a W the way I told you, then the thing I call ET is greater than the mass of the W, and the thing I've defined as MT is less than the mass of the W. So that's why I intentionally labeled them differently. Clearly, they're not the same. All right. Yeah. So for next time, I mean, there's some interesting properties of the collider physics for pair production of two particles that Philip will go over. But really, the main point of this is to sort of orient ourselves, understand what the distributions look like for the standard model processes, because they're the backgrounds for looking for new physics processes. So if you want to ask, is there supersymmetry? The way to experimentally address that is to look for the decay chains of superpartners. To do that, you have to cut away from all the products of W's and Z's that we're producing all the time at the LHC. So there's sort of two purposes to this. Basic orientation in kinematics, so that you have a language to describe what these events look like, and then also knowing what the backgrounds are to beyond the standard model processes, which are what we're ultimately interested in looking for. All right. Sorry that went long.